Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
What's going on, everybody, and Happy New Year, or Merry Christmas, and all that good stuff. It has been a long 2 weeks since we've all gotten together and shared our love for all things World War II history. I hope everybody in the listening audience had a great Christmas and a Happy New Year, and Santa Claus brought you everything that you want. And some of the things you didn't ask for, you got anyway. But it's nice seeing everybody again. Joining us, as always, is Mr. Jeff Copsetta, Mr. Henry Sledge, and our special guest tonight is Mr. Matt DePalma. We'll get into Matt here momentarily. Just a little refresher for the audience. How was your all's Christmases and New Year's, Jeff, Henry, Matt?
Well, man, I'll tell you, you know, for me, it's always the best Christmas because it seems like I've always got a newborn Christmas, and first helps. Christmas around this household. But I will say I'm a little disappointed because, I mean, I did everything you were supposed to do. I wrote a list. I sat on Henry's lap, and I still didn't get a 50 cal. So I don't know what I got to do next year.
Yeah, you know, sometimes Santa's a little reluctant to put that in a sleigh. You know, deers get a little anxious when they got live
live munitions.
Thank you. Live munition around and heavy-ass guns. How was yours, Henry?
Oh, it was fantastic. Got a bunch of books.
Did you get half the books that we've talked about in the last 3 months on this podcast?
Yeah, actually, September Hope was one of them.
Fantastic. I just finished that, and I'm into the Peleliu Tragic Triumph. And, Henry, there's something I got to ask you about in there that I've learned about Pavuvu that was never really mentioned in some of the other documentation I've read. But speaking of books, joining us is author, historian, and all-around interesting fellow, Mr. Matt DePalma. Matt, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor and pleasure to be here.
Now, I noticed that flag behind you, and if my memory serves from standing at attention at the beginning of every VKE for the last 5.5 years, it usually rolls sometimes near the Marine Corps birthday. You, in fact, sir, were and still are a Marine, correct?
That is correct. I was 10 years of salt amphib. And it was 82 to 92. So it's been a little while, but as you know by my demeanor at VKE, that some things just never really leave you.
Absolutely. As I open up the show, you have an interesting background. Just for the sake of our audience, and is that your microphone or your camera?
Oh, that's the light so that everybody can see what I look like.
That's all good.
Maybe I should turn this off. Everybody wants to know what I look like. But
you got a fancy ring light and all. You stole that from your daughter, though, didn't you?
Technical issue there. I'll try and keep an eye on it for you.
No worries. But for the sake of our audience, give us a little Reader's Digest of your background, as you just mentioned, your service in the Marine Corps. But give us a little background in your other extracurricular activities that brought you into doing some pretty cool stuff, as I learned about looking at your bio tonight.
Yes, definitely. I was born on Guam in 1960. Dad was stationed there. It was Mom and Dad's first duty station together as a married couple. And it allows me to claim having a direct connection to World War II in that when I was born on Guam, there were still 23 Japanese soldiers on the island who were not aware that the war was over. So I'm not a World War II veteran. I'm so close. So I can claim that as my, direct connection to World War II.
You know, it's interesting because, we always hear about the one particular cat who held out until what, early 70s it was, but
yeah,
you're saying there's 23.
1974. What was his name? Onoda.
Onoda. Yep.
Yeah.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't they have to, like, go track down his old surviving, like, commanding officer to get him to go come out of the woods? Is that true or is that folklore? Yeah.
They did. They had to find him so that they could bring him to Guam and give Lieutenant Onoda the order to surrender. Because otherwise he was afraid that surrendering would be a dishonor to his family and to the Japanese Empire. But when the former commander came out and gave him the order to surrender, that's when he surrendered. And of course, you know, thankfully he came back to a hero's welcome because he had held out as a point of honor. So when he came back to Japan, he thought he was returning in disgrace, but it was the exact opposite.
Now, did anybody, or maybe he even did anybody ghostwrite or fill in and do a biography? It would be interesting to see how he survived all those years.
Yeah, there's a book out there.
I've read his book.
So, yeah, there you go.
But it's been years ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
I'll have to track that down, because that'd be so, I mean, obviously the surviving that long, but just the day in, day out surviving. I mean, clearly he wasn't getting any rations or any supplies dropped. He just had to scrounge and whatever, just surviving out there alone.
Yeah, he was living off the land.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Stealing what he could from the locals, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Wasn't that in the Philippines?
There was another group that was in the Philippines. There was another group that was in Burma. It was two men who held out, and they weren't military. They were actually military contractors who were there as part of like a construction battalion or something. They didn't get the hero's welcome because they were staying alive by thievery and a couple of other dishonorable deeds. But yeah, Onoda was the most famous one.
So on Guam, you said they had 23 of them.
And what, 1960 when I was born.
1960.
Yeah. A lot of them came out of the woods shortly after I left. You know, it's like they were just waiting for me to leave.
All that DePalma baby's gone. Let's come out.
Exactly. Got rid of another Marine.
And so after you left Guam and your life progressed, what roads did you travel down?
Being a Navy brat, we served in a number of spots, Virginia Beach, Hawaii, Pensacola, Jacksonville, Florida. Dad was 29 years Navy. I went to University of Florida, took up graphic design and illustration there.
No, that's the old school graphic design. That's not Photoshop and computers. That's light tables and razor blades.
Yeah, that was Rubolith and stat cameras, so that goes back quite a ways. That's where I picked up my love of football and graphic design together. The company I worked for had an exclusive with Walmart to provide all of the collegiate T-shirts in Florida and through much of the Southeast. Screw the light.
It's good without it. Don't worry about it. You're good without it.
Technology, phooey. But at any rate, that's where I got my love for all of these championship games. Henry, doing a lot of the bowl designs and designs for the various schools and such like that. So it was a great experience. Got me launched into graphic design. It's where I picked up using the computer, which is what I do now. I'm currently a graphic designer for a company called Jacobs, which is a very large company that does a lot of government contracts. I work in the technology section. I do a lot of the graphic design for the proposals we submit to the government.
Fun. Now, you're one of the few we've had on the show who dedicates their historical reenacting and research, and we'll get to here momentarily, your years of graphic design has led you into publishing some interesting books and helping out in the hobby. But with your background and all your knowledge on World War II and the military, what led you to, what sparked your fascination with the German side?
We do obviously have the prettier uniforms, but you know, apart from
you
that,
had Hugo Boss on your side. We just had some people with some.
I had to bring that up.
That was spoken from a true Marine, wasn't it?
Yeah, buddy.
Jeff is Army, by the way. So Jeff served as well.
Oh, awesome! Thanks for your service, Jeff. But at any rate, I first got interested in it when I was growing up. My uncle Dave was a 36th Infantry Division veteran. He landed in Salerno in 1943. He was in the Louisiana maneuvers in 1940. He served at Anzio, Rome, Leary Valley, Monte Cassino, Rapido River. I mean, a lot of the really early, really bad experiences for a U.S. Army soldier to have to experience. And I think I was 10, maybe 11 at the time when I asked him, you know, who had the best army in Europe during World War II? And I fully expected him to say the U.S. did, just out of, you know, pride of having served and whatnot. Now, he wasted no time whatsoever and said the Germans without even hesitation. He said that the Germans were better equipped, better led, had better discipline, and were easily the most professional army in Europe during World War II. And at reenactments, and especially at VKE, I know you've heard me say this, Don, but the most impressive and important thing is our guys beat them. Mm-hmm. They turned the most professional army in Europe around and very soundly beat them. And it wasn't just our guys, of course. You know, there was an awful lot that contributed to it. It wasn't just the grunts on the ground, but that played a major part of it. And as such, you know, my Uncle Dave had that level of respect for the German soldier. I started doing research into them and you know, what was it that made them different? Because there weren't very many of them that were members of the Nazi Party. So, you know, you could portray a German soldier, and I like getting out of the reenactments and doing the best I can using all of my tactical knowledge that I acquired as a jarhead, and doing what I can to make it as difficult for the Americans as I can, because that's really the kind of legacy we're trying to show. I mean, the reenactors want to let them know that this wasn't the Hollywood World War II. This wasn't a matter of us going in knowing full well we were going to win this. This also wasn't a cakewalk for the GIs and the Brits and the Marines and everybody else that participated. This was one heck of a thing that had to be done. And they rose to the challenge. And, you know, like Tom Brokaw says, the greatest generation. They rose to the challenge, did what had to be done, and defeated, you know, what is very easily recognized as probably one of the most heinous organizations the human race has ever turned out.
Yeah, Matt, I've got a comment there. You may be interested. Something I just came across listening to a history lecture, really mainly talking about the Peloponnesian Wars, and how, you know, we look at how basically what we get our knowledge from that is mostly from Thucydides. And how his outlook was. And it's interesting, and the guy doing the lecture brought up, you know, when they look at that 27-year period, you know, it was kind of broken up in chunks where we've kind of collectively, it's the Peloponnesian War, it lasted, you know, 27 years. But he made the comparison to how will people 1,000 years from now see the German military? Are they going to see World War One and World War Two, or are they going to see the German Empire? And like so many other empires in history, they had these sort of micro wars, you know, the Punic Wars, but they weren't, it wasn't over. It was a war and then a breather. And I'm curious to see your input on that. And, you know, or what is your opinion on that? The mighty German army, do you think future historians will see it not like we do in two separate world wars, but more of a coming up, a breather, and then a final, you know, push?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, you there's no way you could have had World War II without having had World War I and the Versailles Treaty first. That much is definitely obvious. But I mean, there's enough written now that I don't think that they will blend the two in 1,000 years. Of course, a lot can happen between now and then, so nobody knows for sure, but may have to come back and figure that one out later. But I think that because you're talking about two very distinct countries, Germany prior to 1918 and Germany post 1933, and there was plenty of mess that happened in between the two. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I'm working on right now, one of the books I'm working on, is the Allied air offensive through German paperwork. I'm working on kind of like a pre volume of that, where I concentrate on Germany preparing between 1933 and 1939 with their air defenses. But in order to understand that, you have to look at everything that happened from Versailles and through the Weimar Republic, and why the Weimar Republic was so reviled at the time. So I really don't think that there's going to be that combining of the two, like with the Peloponnesian War, because that's a really good point to make. But I think because of that Weimar era in between the two, that historians in the future will be able to keep the two separated.
Now, one of the books, you have three published books, but one of them, which is very interesting, kind of leading off of what you're just talking about, the book you're working on now, you have the German Military Travel Papers of the Second World War. How did that project come about? And maybe leading into that is, how did you take your graphic design history knowledge and say, hey, you know, there's a need or a desire just for my own fun to start researching and recreating some of this important paperwork?
Yeah, well, thanks. I've been collecting paperwork for about 30 years, all sorts of historical paperwork. I have documents, newspapers, ephemera, all sorts of stuff. I think the oldest piece I got is like 1740.
Wow.
And then up through Second World War and into the early years of the Cold War. And I just collected all of this because, you know, I couldn't afford to collect firearms. I couldn't afford to collect helmets and canteens and uniforms. And plus, I really didn't have any place to put them, even if I did. These white binders that you see behind me are all filled with various eras of paperwork.
See, that was going to be my next question is some of that stuff. Well, paperwork, you know, it disintegrates. You know, Jeff's worked in museums and Henry has experience with museums. And Jeff, you have your microphone muted for some reason. But how do you prevent the disintegration and storage of them? And furthermore, when you said, you know, you didn't have the money for canteens or the space for helmets, one might argue collecting paperwork is a hell of a lot harder because, one, less of it was manufactured than M1 helmets, and two, as I just previously stated, the fragile conditions in which they can easily disintegrate, especially German paper, you know, paperwork that was probably at some point tried to be destroyed when they were, you know, running from the Allies. That's a worthy cause to try to collect all that stuff and preserve it.
Well, I'm doing my part. I don't know what museum is going to end up with all of this when I pass. Penny and I, my wife, we don't have any kids. So if you know of a good museum to recommend it to, or a good auction house, depending on whether I kick off before she does.
What's the old saying? My biggest fear is that I die and my wife sells all my guns for what I told her I paid them for.
Exactly. Well, I'm in luck because Penny and I met reenacting ages ago. I'm not going to say how long, but
2010.
Seriously, though, we've been married for over 37 years. We met reenacting, and just about everybody I know that I reenact with have pretty much said that I have the coolest wife on the planet because I can go spend, you know, $50 or $100 on a single piece of paper. And when I show it to her, her reaction is cool. You know? So it's not really an issue of you paid how much for that. You know, she understands the value of the document as a historical, item, plus as an investment. A lot of my paperwork is appreciated over the years because I've been collecting it for so darn long. But that was really what got me going. I know you're familiar with William Zukauskas, another reenactor down there in Florida. He's been a good friend of mine. Well, actually, I think I've known Bill longer than I've known Penny. But he's a wonderful person, really kind of inspired me to collect a lot of the paperwork that I have and all. because I see his collection, and you know, he doesn't collect paperwork. He collects all those things I can't afford. But he's got a fabulous collection, and he's always willing and eager to share knowledge about it and everything, and to show it to people who inquire. I mean, he's just a really wonderful guy, and it's like, man, I want to collect, but I can't afford to collect that other stuff. So I'll collect paperwork because I know graphic design, I know printing. I've worked in electronic pre-press. I've worked on Heidelberg machines. I've worked on a lot of different kinds of presses. So I had an understanding already of what went into creating the paperwork. It's in addition to the typography and everything else. And then when you start to look at what these different kinds of paper have in common, it becomes pretty easy after a while to look at something and say, well, this is, you know, this is like mid-19th century French. You can tell by looking at the typesetting, the layout, the kind of paper that was used, that sort of thing. And it's also intriguing to me because a lot of the printing standards today came from turn of the last century Germany. The DIN standards, the European paper sizes, all came from Deutsches Institut für Normung, which is the German Institute for Standardization. Europe adopted that after World War II because, you know, it kind of made a lot of sense. And Germany really raised the bar for design around the same time period. You had the Bauhaus, you had Jugendstil and Art Nouveau, French and German running concurrently. So that center of Europe is really what shaped a lot of the design norms that we follow today in Western society.
Very interesting. I mean, I can only, you know, your graphic design, like I said, when you go and you could tell typeset and the history of the paper and all that, it's just, that's not something that a lot of people get into. And it's very, like I said before, very admirable that you're going through to preserve that paperwork. And it's got to be hard to kind of track that stuff down, opposed to, once again, your hundreds and thousands of canteens, the helmets, the jackets, and all that stuff to find. And plus, being over here in the United States, do you find that you're importing a lot of your paperwork? Are you going online and finding auctions or sales, eBay overseas? I mean, how do you come across a lot of your German stuff?
Yeah, pretty much all of that. There's vet bringbacks. I've got a couple pieces of paper that veterans brought back that they've kept in their estate. I have been to Germany, Austria, and Italy a few times. Had a wonderful time wandering through. I do speak German, so as far as hunting for paperwork in Germany and Austria, it's not quite that challenging. The difficult thing, though, is they're not allowed to sell anything with a swastika on it.
Yeah.
Nobody is allowed to display anything unless you work for a museum and whatnot. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get it.
Yeah.
That means you got to be cautious how you do it. In one particular case, Penny and I went to an antique store in, I guess it was Vienna. And we went in and I told the proprietor, very nice lady who was about my age, I told her I was looking for documents and paperwork from the 1930s and 40s. And she said, oh, we don't have any sold books. And I'm like, no, I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for the daily papers that the average Austrian might have carried with them during that time. And she said, well, I've got this. And it was what they call a Sparbuch. It's a savings book. And whenever you made a deposit at the bank, you would write how much that was. It's kind of like a checkbook register, mm-hmm. but it was for a savings account. And I said, I'll take it. And she said, well, it's the equivalent of $10. It was in shillings at the time. I think it was like 120 shillings or something. It was pre-euro. And I said, no, that's okay. This is exactly what I'm looking for. And I started explaining my interest in history and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And we got to chatting, and I was keeping up in my German, which I think kind of impressed her too. So she said, well, I did just get something from an estate sale. Let me go into the back and see, you know, see if I, if you might be interested in some of that. So she comes out and she has this box filled with all sorts of different identity papers. And one of the ladies who was involved with this estate was a member of the German Italian Bund prior to 1943. And she had all of her paperwork, all of her correspondence, all of her ID cards of this organization of German and Italian friendship prior to the Italian capitulation in September of 43. And there were swastikas on everything. I mean, it was just loaded with them, all sorts of ID cards and the postal savings account books. And I mean, we chatted even further. She said, well, would you be interested in any of this? And I'm like, oh, yes.
Matt said $50 American sold.
Yeah. So it was really cool because, you know, then I realized that, you know, it says, yeah, the paperwork's there. You just kind of have to let everybody know that you're not part of the police department. You're not trying to entrap anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You are a genuine collector. You're not some sort of neo-Nazis going to wave this under people's noses and such.
And I'm sure being on that side of the hobby, you know, you kind of have to deal with those. When someone first meets you, perhaps comes into your office, there's a sideways glance you have to maybe quickly correct.
That happens a lot. Everybody kind of wants to salute you just the wrong way.
Especially now.
You have to kind of neck it back a little and say, no, that's not what this is about. I got to admit, though, the funniest situation occurred when I was being interviewed for my security clearance. The gentleman from the Office of Personnel Management came out and was giving me all sorts of questions and whatnot. And he said, is there anything on the internet that somebody might be able to use to blackmail you? And I said, what, you mean other than the pictures of me in a German uniform?
Complete with leather jacket.
His eyes got real big for a moment. I said, no, I'm a historical reenactor. Everybody I know knows it. And if they're going to use that as blackmail, then they're really not digging very far.
Because your uniform is like, it's pristine. It's spot on. I mean, it's one of the best German uniform impressions I've seen. It's
so what, when you're in uniform, what are you portraying?
I have a couple of different portrayals that I have. One is Hermann Göring, division. I have the, tropical and the, regular, Fliegerbluse, for that. Also a member of the 228th Panzerjäger, and Don, you probably remember Mike Kessinger and those guys.
I didn't come along until after Kessinger was, you know, was no longer. I started doing VKE probably. I've only been reenacting for 8 years, so I'm a little late to the Florida party.
Oh, okay. Well, that's all right. We won't hold that against you. But that would be an individual I'd recommend that you come. If you're interested in getting another Axis individual, Mike Kessinger, really, really nice guy. He was the, obviously because of the VKE title, he was the first general and I was one of his toadies. And I played an SS officer who, you know, just checked everybody's papers. And I found out something really interesting. If you're wearing a German uniform and you start talking to somebody in German and they don't understand German, they get really nervous really fast.
Especially start yelling at them. So
it's a great way to interact with the public. And because the whole point of the VKE with the Germans on the train is to make people uncomfortable so that those people can understand exactly what it was that you know, that the people of Europe went through under the oppression of the Germans. And it's also kind of amusing when you start talking to them in German and they respond in German.
Yeah, especially down here. Because
like, okay, we can have some fun now.
Yeah, this area of Florida and southern Florida, we're real huge on the German tourism board.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, especially down here in southwest Florida. Like when I first moved down here, like the German equivalent of the Discovery Channel was doing shows down here. I got four or five German clients. And let me tell you, when I go work on their computers and you ask them for a password, you know what they do? They turn around and grab one of those white binders behind you. They have every single password, every piece of serial code. Even in that, even modern day Germans are very, very into documentation. They're my only computer client that can provide me with anything I've ever asked for, as far as software, key codes, passwords, anything. They have it all in white binders, just like yours, right behind them. Every one of them. It's
that's not at all unusual. Yeah, it's very true. The concept of German efficiency is still very alive and living very well. We had a friend of ours from Bersching, which is a small walled city outside of Nuremberg, who met us in Salzburg when we were there. And we were talking to him on the phone, and he said, well, we can come by about 10 o'clock. How's 10 o'clock sound? And we're like, perfect. Here's the address for the hotel that we're staying at. We'll meet you at 10. My brother stepped outside to grab a smoke, and here he sees our friend and his wife wandering down the street, and he looks at his watch and he says, to the second, it was 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother went, you're here. And he says, of course, it is 10 o'clock and I am German.
Now, you have a book on your German paperwork, and I saw on your Amazon author description that you've done some paperwork for certain, a little bit of Hollywood, some TV shows and some productions and stuff like that.
Yes.
How does that come to light?
Well, that started out with when I did my Repro Paperwork website, I started reproducing things in my collection that was kind of stuff that I would like to have, like the travel papers and ration cards, things like that. And I was contacted out of the blue by, and I'm sorry, his name escapes me right now, but he was the art director for Royal Pains, which was a television show about a concierge doctor in, I think it was Martha's Vineyard, or in New England anyway. His number one client was this mysterious individual of German descent, and he contacted me because he wanted to know, could I do the birth certificates or any supporting documents for this character, who at one point in the show turns over all of his records, medical and otherwise, to this concierge doctor. He had some of the paperwork, like naturalization papers for, you know, a German that had emigrated to the United States in the 1940s, but he didn't have anything prior. So I put together birth certificates and paperwork going back to about the 1850s, 1820s, and sent those to him, and they aged them appropriately and everything. If you watch that series, if you're familiar with that series, I did about half of the paperwork in that big old dossier for Royal Pains. He enjoyed what I'd put together so much that he put me in touch with, Fringe. That's the name of it. A TV show that needed Soviet paperwork. And because I collect Soviet documents, I took Russian at the University of Florida, and I've lost almost all of it, but I can still read and write Cyrillic. So as long as I have a good Russian English dictionary, I can do a pretty good job.
Google Translate.
it took some doing, but thankfully it stuck with me. One of these days I'm going to pick up Arabic, but that's another story. At any rate, I did paperwork for that television show as well. And they put me in touch with the art director for the movie Sucker Punch, They needed some World War One paperwork. And if you remember the scene, if you've seen the movie where the German officer in the trench flips the table up and all the papers go flying, about a half of those are mine.
You know, it's interesting because you would think as a casual observer, oh, they just got some yellow paper, just type a bunch of random letters on it and then stuck it on there because the cameras don't get close up. The fact that they hired you to come up with authentic paperwork that you're not going to see the font while it's flying through the air, that just goes to show how much they put in their production.
Well, it's IMDb syndrome. Everybody on IMDb will like pause a movie and on this UHD TV screen zoom in to see as that paperwork wasn't used until 1944. Why are they using it in 1939?
Yeah, we're real bad about that here. His name's Matt DePalma. He has many books. German Military Travel Papers, For the Love of Dora, Discovering Our World, and The Women in My... Is that The Women in My Uniform?
Women in My Uniform, yes.
And you can check him out at repopaperwork.com. Matt, please hang out with us for the rest of the show and join in on the conversation, because I figure having you on here, what a better time. There's a time in the show we like to suggest books to people, and I have one that I was talking about before we went on the air, and I want to get talking to Henry about real quick, and I'm sure Jeff has cracked a few books over the last 2 weeks. I'm sure Henry probably has one he wants to suggest. And by all means, Matt, you seem like somebody probably reads some books yourself. And so if you have a book or two you want to suggest, by all means. But real quick, I actually ordered this during the show one time. You guys remembered it was Peleliu, Tragic Triumph. I believe you read this one. Have you not, Henry?
I have. It's been a long time, but I have.
I was reading this book. Now, we all know from The Pacific and Helmet for My Pillow and that little book with the old breed that there's some discussion about Pavuvu, but it's primarily talking about land crabs and rats and this and that. And one of the things I learned from this book was how damn small the island was, to the fact that they didn't have enough room to have a quality gun range or even places for the replacements to get kind of cycled in and learn battle exercises. And you know, you guys know I can't read for shit, but I'm going to read this real quick. It says, from the beginning to the end, training on Pavuvu was little short of pandemonium and frustration. Company streets were the only areas where men could engage in mock attacks. It was routine to see one outfit charging full tilt between rows of tents and other troops in formation stand at a rigid attention for rifle inspection, or other units practicing close order drills. Quote, this would have been fine if we were getting Japs out of tents, but it's a whole different story considering we're going after reinforced bunkers. And one of the things that remind me of, just the idea and thought of these guys doing battle exercises through the streets and around tents, and I've talked about this before, is when I first got into reenacting, I filmed a first ID. One of the things John would have us do at some of these events was, because we were never together, was have us do little tactical exercises through the reenactment village. And I always thought it felt so dumb to see us going through tents and hiding behind a blacksmith and all that. But so when I read that paragraph out of here, I just had flashbacks of us doing the same thing. Henry, did your dad ever really get into conversations with you, or have you heard him talking about other things about Pavuvu other than the rats and the land crabs, about how small it was and the living conditions? Because this book makes it sound like Pavuvu was the worst thing to happen to the Marines for restaging.
I've actually been going through some of his papers that were never published for a project I'm working on, but he said a lot of stuff about Pavuvu that didn't make it into With the Old Breed. But one of the things, I didn't know this, I think one of the reasons they chose Pavuvu was they wanted an isolated island where the guys could train.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think after, it may have been 3rd Marine Division after Bougainville, when they took those guys to Guadalcanal to let them rest and refit. And like they were, you know, fortifying Guadalcanal into a major rear area base, which it was very vibrant by the time my dad got in theater. But they were taking so many guys and siphoning them off into work parties and work details that the guys could hardly get any rest. And here, if I have the timing of this right in my head, they were just coming off Bougainville, so they needed to rest. And then with all the work details and work parties, I mean, they just could hardly get any of that done before they had to start you know, training for their next operation. So I think that was one reason why they chose Pavuvu, was it was so remote and out of the way.
But one of the problems they were saying in this book is it was scouted from plane. And I guess some of the leading commanders, they said if they would have landed the damn plane or even took a boat in and walked 200 yards off the beach and saw how bad the soil was and how bad the conditions were, they would have never picked that island. I guess the living conditions and just – and I guess there's the jungle was so thick and the terrain was so inhospitable that henceforth those guys – training amongst other men, they're saying they couldn't even set up a quality gun range. They were basically plinking at coconuts on sandbags. And so it was, they were just going through the motions. And according to this book, which it's interesting because this book, Peleliu, the Tragic Triumph, for a book on Peleliu, they do a lot on Guadalcanal and leading up to it. So you can kind of see all the decisions and shortcomings that came to the Peleliu landings. And it's so far, it's a great book. But no, when I was reading, I was like, well, you know, I just heard about the land crab and the rats and the weather sucked. I didn't know that it was so damn small that they really couldn't even get training. And it took forever for the guys to kind of get, I guess, acclimated to the environment before they could actually start recovering. So they weren't even really recovering mentally or physically forever until they finally, you know, got that kind of place in a ship shape area.
Yeah. And it really, when they came back from Peleliu, it was a little better. But not by a heck of a lot. You know, by then, of course, they could – I mean, I think Pavuvu is, what, 60 miles north of Guadalcanal.
Mm-hmm.
So they could – I think Benica was not too far away. Sometimes the guys would go to Benica because it was pretty well built up by then, as was Guadalcanal, obviously.
Yeah, according to this book, your father made a few trips over there as well. Did he ever talk about Benica at all other than what we saw?
Again, some of the stuff I've been going through that was unpublished, he talked about it quite a bit. He talked about watching the local islanders build the chaplain hut on Pavuvu, you know, and the way they would, the native islanders would work together to their construction methods and stuff like that. He was really interested in that. I don't think that made it into with the old breed.
No, I don't think so either. So, Henry, I'll put it in your court. What book have you been reading, and what suggestions?
Well, I finished Spearhead, which Jeff and I had kind of talked about a little bit. I finished that. Actually, just a couple of days ago, finished Bomber Boys by Patrick Bishop, also wrote Fighter Boys. So, I actually finished that just yesterday. So, for Christmas, one of the Christmas books I got was Alamo and the Ardennes by our friend John McManus.
Mm-hmm.
So I may dive into that next. I was either that or I was thinking, I mean, it's still kind of cold to start getting back into Pacific reading, but I'm really wanting to reread John Parshall's book on Midway, Shattered Sword, because I got the movie, I got the Blu-ray Midway and Fury. Jack gave me Fury for Christmas for my birthday.
Midway is probably one of the more underrated World War II movies come out in the last, 10 years or so?
I really liked it, but what did you, not to sway from that, but I'm interested in all three. What did you guys think of Fury?
I liked Fury. Fury was good. It was interesting because when Fury came out, that was right around the time I was training heavily with Second Armored, and so I was spending a lot of time walking with Sherman tanks. I really liked it. I liked how they did the ending. Instead of it being all Hollywood and everybody went home to be a hero, only one person, spoiler alert, survived. I enjoy it. I have it on DVD. I watch it. I really don't have anything to nitpick about it. I will say it wasn't until the second or possibly the third time I watched it that the first time I watched it, the whole horse and just the way the guys acted in that apartment around everybody just kind of irked me. But after the second and third time of watching, I kind of got the point they're going for. You know, trying to knock Brad Pitt down off his high horse a little bit. And, you know, the storytelling was trying to, you know, deliver a story of how horrible war is. But the first time I saw it, that scene really irked me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's usually what I will fast forward through if I'm watching it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but when I was in Assault Amphib, it was Armor. So I was thankful to see a World War II film that did justice to the Shermans and the guys that served in the tanks and whatnot. So, having to fix track or fix a road wheel or anything like that is like, yep, been there. I could appreciate that. I did enjoy the history of it the fact that you are looking at the desperation of the Germans in 1945 and how so many of them just wanted it to be over. One of the common sayings in Germany in 44 and 45 was, enjoy the war, the peace will be terrible. And it's so true in so many ways, but and that's one of the things I'm studying right now. And another piece of work that I'm looking at is Germany in the first 5 years after the war, how that led into the Cold War, and how and why East and West Germany became two separate nations. They really did, just because the shooting stopped didn't mean that everything went back to normal. And you really got a sense for that in the first half of Fury, I thought.
Be honest, how many times did you pause the movie when they were in the office looking at the paperwork, making sure it was up to your stuff?
It never occurred to be honest. All right, honey, get the get Fury out. You know?
What about you, Jeff? What have you been reading?
Like Henry said, I'm not all the way through Spearhead yet. I've got a little bit left. I'm a little slower reader than Henry, but man, what an incredible book. And I was not armored, but I did have to graduate armored reconnaissance school to, in the event that I could be set in as with a Bradley fighting vehicle. Thankfully I was not, because I, after going through the Bradley course, I didn't want to be anywhere near that piece of equipment in combat. Now, a lot of the guys that I started with ended up in a Bradley unit. They loved it. No thanks. And, you know, the time that I put in driving and maintaining and firing World War II tanks on reenactment battlefields today, me and my dad actually put a brand new set of tracks on a half track that was 8 hours.
Wow.
To do it. So, no, thank you. You can have all of that. Before we get too far, because I don't want to forget, and I will. I know we have a lot of reenactors that listen to this podcast. So the reenactor in me, and I'm a new reenactor as well, but the reenactor in me, if I was listening, I would want to tell Matt, I would want to tip my hat to Matt for, to really get into character like that. You know, I'm still kind of, I'm in between. I'm still kind of like, I just want to dress up and have fun and keep history alive. And then let's work on like pocket trash. What would, you know, the things you'd have in your pocket, what's your favorite song? What would be your favorite football team? You know, things like that. What Life magazine should be in this picture, you know, that we take, things like that.
Which so pocket kind of should I put my spoon in? Cause that's all I need. I threw my fork and my knife away. Things like that.
Yeah. Stuff like that. So just that little bit, you know, next level kind of stuff. But you know, to have a journey, and I'll tell you, I have a good buddy of mine who, he's a retired Marine gunning sergeant who is one of the best German reenactors that I know of. I mean, he can do just about anything. You know, he also does Marines in the Pacific in World War II, but his German, and he speaks it, you know, I mean, he really, really knows his stuff. And he's just recently restored a few German helmets for me at my museum here, because his knowledge base is incredible. And, you know, that's important. I mean, I couldn't imagine, you know, I don't even want to do airborne. Now, I got a buddy that just gave me a real nice airborne uniform. This guy's a jump master with the airborne demonstration team here. We had him on a couple episodes ago, actually. We had him on our podcast. And I wouldn't even want to be airborne because I wouldn't begin to know, you know, without going through a jump school, and I'm never going to do that. My back is trash. I have no business doing that. So to be able to take, you know, a uniform from a whole nother country and really delve in like you have, to know the culture, you know, just the atmosphere, it's so impressive. But am I the only one that appreciates the irony? of a Marine that was born on an island that still had live Japanese soldiers on it is going to grow up to be a German reenactor.
Wait until I've
been laughing in my head about that this whole time.
Wait until I update the website and I post photos of Matt. You know, Matt's chilling here. He's got his beard on. He's got his glasses, his hair. He's got his nice warm sweater on. Wait until you see him in this damn uniform. It's
there's some pictures up. I want to see this.
I don't have.
Is that possible?
I was actually looking.
Let me see what I can find here.
Well, while you're looking for that, one of the things that always, and I guess we have a lot of new listeners, and we've covered VKE. I've had Meg on. I've had Art on in the past, but we got new listeners. So while you're looking for those photos, Matt. Just a quick synopsis. VKE is Von Kessinger Express. It's at the Florida National, the Florida Train Museum. We've talked about it in the past. Civilians come, they buy train tickets, and when they show up, there's like a 25-foot-tall swastika flag. There's Germans walking around. They give them paperwork that Matt probably provides. They get on the train. The train actually moves. The track's like 4 to 6 miles long. While they're on the train, Matt and his asshole buddies are screaming at people and handing out paperwork and accosting young children. And the train stops about 2 miles down. They get out. They execute a pilot. This year, me and my airborne buddies attempted to put on a good show. It didn't take until day two to get it sorted out because, well, that's what happens. You know, I learned, Jeff, that reenactors with vehicles don't like to get out of their vehicles, but that's another story for another time. But anyhow, have a skirmish. The train goes down to the end of the track. There's another skirmish. The Americans take over. On the way back, Art and Matt do a lot of improv, ad-libbing. They put on a show. It's kind of like a murder mystery train ride without the murder and the dinner. And it's very – I love it because if you're into improv, if you're into acting of any sort, you go on a train, you stay in character as an ally. We're looking for the German paperwork. We're looking – talking to the people. We're – you know, accosting the Germans, and it's all in all, it's a good time. And so shout out to Matt and the people who put that event on, and shout out. And we had Paul on back in 2020 in order to keep this thing alive. You guys are like, well, what are we going to do about the mask thing? Right. We need mask. How are we going to do mask in 1944? And that's when Paul came up with the idea. Well, we'll just make it a tuberculosis train. It's a hospital train, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that explained why. And so all the reenactors, we had Eric Recht mask on, but that's how we got around. We just changed up the storyline, made it a hospital train, and that would basically justified everybody having mask on. And so any luck finding pictures?
I've got one. I'm not sure how to go about
it. I was looking for them on Facebook because I was going to share it. But anyhow, we'll post them up on the website,
okay.
WTSPWorldWar2.com for those of you listening at home. At the beginning of our little Christmas break, after we had John C. McManus on, I stumbled across the movie on Netflix, and I sent you two a text message saying your homework. Did you guys check that movie out?
I read about it.
The Forgotten Battle?
I know what it's about. It looks pretty solid.
Have you seen that, Jeff? The Forgotten Battle?
I don't even recall the text message.
Yeah. Have you seen that one, Matt? It's on Netflix. It's about, it's kind of about Market Garden, but it's about the Battle of the Sledge. How do you put it?
The Schelde Estuary.
Yes. And, and the great thing is it's a Dutch movie. And unlike American movies where we just have everybody speak in English, each country in person spoke their correct language. And so when the English and the Americans were on there, it was all in English. When the Germans were on there, it was all in German and so on. And the Dutch resistance. But basically, and I even reached out to McManus, like, did you see this movie? He's like, yeah, I thought it was great. The first movie I can recall modern days that they show the inside of a glider. They show the British glider riders going in, the Dutch resistance. It's a fantastic movie, but it's about that ending of, you know, the Operation Market Garden era that we're talking about with McManus. And, it's fantastic. You guys got to watch it. It's really, really well done. And it's like I said, it's a Dutch movie, I want to say.
Yeah, but you're correct. Yeah.
It's fantastic. You guys got to check it out. Maybe watch it on the weekend or something. But it's very, very, very cool. And I didn't know that Montgomery's son basically weaseled his way into that mission. He was a glider rider, and his glider was shot down. him and four survivors of his gliders were like 50 miles from the drop zone. They were in a flooded area and just trying to survive, and their leading commander was basically paralyzed, and they were floating him around on a makeshift raft. And it's a damn good movie. So that's my suggestion for all y'all listen. It's on Netflix. It's called The Forgotten Battle. It's very,
very
good.
I've got one that's not a suggestion to watch. I came across the other day. The Eagle Has Landed.
Not familiar with it.
I remember that one.
Keep it that way, Don.
Yeah.
So it sounds great. Okay. It's a brief synopsis is they want to send German paratroopers to England dressed as Polish soldiers to capture Winston Churchill. Okay.
What could go wrong?
All I have to tell you is it is done in 1976. All I have to tell you is Michael Caine is a German.
Mike Cocaine.
I'll stop there.
The novel is much better than the movie. You're talking about 1970s movie capabilities, and it was not a big budget film by any stretch.
The head of wardrobe was
the novel.
Donald Sutherland, you know, I will say Robert Duvall played a great part in it. He also plays plays a German. Donald Pleasence plays Himmler. I'm not trying to trash. I'm just saying that's maybe one you may not want to go after. But I did agree. I don't know who said it a minute ago because I'm a huge Midway fan. I think that movie was great. I relish the conversation that I had with the military advisor for that film, Harlan Glenn. I spent over an hour on the phone. We were just back and forth. We just clicked that day and spoke the same language. And some of the stuff I kind of was like, you don't want to like sound like, you don't be that guy.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, hey, just curious. How about, you know, what about, why did y'all, you know, and I just kind of weaseled into, you know, some of the things that I thought, why did y'all end up doing that instead of, you know, what was documented is what really was and things like that. But, you know, and that's when I really started learning that. And this was right after Walking Point. So I kind of had a pretty good idea of how the movies really kind of go. It's you don't ever blame the advisor for stuff, you know, like
saying that because you were the advisor.
Like, why are you my advisor? You guys are going to do, you're going to do what you want, you know. But you know, Midway kind of, I feel like Midway's kind of got a bad rep. I don't know why.
I was going to say, I almost feel that Midway has the wrong title because it covers a lot more ground than Midway. If the HBO's miniseries didn't exist, it should have been called the Pacific or the PTO something because they cover a lot of ground.
I would have called it Pacific Payback. That's also a book, you know, that there may have been some complications there, I guess. But yeah, I think the title's wrong. And I don't know if it was it the timing? It just seemed like it flopped. And I made sure that I saw it. I was reenacting in West Texas when it opened in theaters. We were doing it was a reunion for the 12th Armored Division out there at the museum out in, I think it's in Abilene.
Cool.
So did a big show for these guys out there. And that was opening weekend. So took all the reenactors, you know, we went to the theaters. And man, as soon as I got home, I took my son and my dad to go see, like, oh man, we got to see this in theaters, you know, before it's too late. And I don't know, it just, not a lot of people are talking about it. You're like, oh, you know, like, since I was a kid, that's the kind of movie I wanted to see.
It really is a good movie. I mean, they do a great job.
I think I agree 100%. I love the movie. I mean, I've watched it three times since I got it, and I'd already seen it in the theater. So I think to comment on that, Jeff, you know, and Matt, way in here, but I think it did well. It made money. It did very well at the box office because I looked it up. I was really interested in that. Mm-hmm. If you feel like people weren't talking about it, think about the national mood.
I was going to say it was 2019.
It's 2019. What's going on in our country? I mean, a bunch of dudes in World War II, a bunch of men being heroes, mm-hmm. and I could add to that, but I'm not. That's not going to get talked about in this day and age, sadly. The movie I thought was great. The shows I watched, like Paul Woodage's World War II TV, he had Drakenfell, who's this big YouTuber, a naval history expert. the things I hear about it that people say that are negative is like heavy on the CGI.
Well, but, how many naval battleships are around?
They're not trashing the movie as a whole.
Yeah. I've heard the same thing. Yeah, it's all so CGI heavy. Well, where's the Akagi right now?
Yes, yeah, exactly. I loved it. I'll keep on watching. I thought it was great.
CGI's not bad as long as you do it well. And I think they succeeded in doing that. I mean, when you can interview veterans and their one complaint was that your altimeter wasn't spinning fast enough, you know, then you've done a pretty darn good job.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was the one quote that stuck with me from a veteran. It says, yeah, when you go on a dive, that thing spins like a top. It wasn't gone fast enough.
Yeah. So let me ask a question here about the dynamics of being in a dive. Let me ask a question to all of you. Wouldn't they have had their goggles down and their canopies closed?
Yeah, but when you're an actor, you want FaceTime, so you always put the goggles up.
Is that what it was?
Would have been down. The canopy's not necessarily closed because we are talking about being in the Pacific in June.
Mm-hmm.
True.
I have heard they left them open because it would fog up the gun sight or the windshield.
That wouldn't surprise me.
I was backed into a corner and someone said, okay, you got to tell me the worst scene or the worst part of Midway. The only scene I could really nitpick and like could have done without was like when he was traversing from one ship to the other via the rope and then it snapped and then he's still hanging on. That's like the only super Hollywood scene in that movie. But it, once again, it's a blockbuster movie meant to be. And that you want that kind of action in there for the general public. So if I was backed in a corner, that would be the only scene I could even nitpick. I think it's a great movie.
Yeah, 100%. But the other thing, Roland Emmerich had to make that as an independent movie, and he had Chinese finance. So think about that. He could not get – you talk about block, but he could not get the Hollywood A-listers to back
him. I don't like A-listers.
So, of course, they're not going to talk about it.
I mean, you got Woody Harrelson's in there, but honestly,
Well, I'm talking about like Paramount Pictures or 20, you know, that's what I mean.
Right. Any of the big producers that would have been able to bankroll that without even blinking.
They didn't want to touch it.
I kind of like what was it? 19, the World War I movie they put out,
1917.
I like movies when they're not chalked, like history movies, when they're not chalked full of A-list actors, because then it doesn't bump you. When you're watching a movie of up-and-comers that you've never seen, like the first time you watch Band of Brothers, and maybe you recognize the one guy from Office Space, but that was about it, and Jimmy Fallon near the end, but to me, when you're watching a great movie and the actors are effing phenomenal and you don't know who they are, you will 5 years from now because they're going to blow up. I love that because it doesn't take you out of it. It doesn't bump you. So I almost prefer not having A-list actors.
Yeah, sometimes A-list actors kind of ruins it for you. Don, real quick, I wanted to mention one more book before we shut it down here. And Don and Henry, you guys already know, and I'll share this with Matt and with all of our listeners. Lost a good friend here recently. Guy that I met probably five or six years ago. And you know, throughout my life, there's been World War II veterans that you kind of latched onto. You know, I've met, and like you guys, I'm sure have, you've met a ton of vets all across the country at different, you know, programs and air shows and everything. And here recently, as I've gotten into reenacting and now running a gosh dang museum, you know, those opportunities, while they should be abundant, they are no longer as abundant because the men are no longer there. So it was a tough one, but we lost Mr. Fred Harvey. Teely is his first name, T. Fred Harvey. And this guy was a paramarine. Served on Bella Bella, Bougainville, and spent 9 days on Iwo Jima before it took three Japanese grenades to come in on him to take him off the island.
Oh,
and I asked him about we were talking about the paramarines one time. He said, you know, Ira Hayes was in my jump school. And of course, that's our famous Pima Indian in the famous photograph on top of Suribachi. I said, yeah, what was he like? He talked, you know, he said, man, I don't think he said 10 words the whole time we were in jump school. You know? But he's just chock full of stories. his humor. I mean, the guy was a real lady killer. Anytime he walked out there with me and put a microphone in front of him, and you know, it's just that kind of, you know, what a guy, what a classy guy. And he has published a book. This one here, I hope it's not backwards.
No, it's good.
Millions, I'd do it again. And this is really his whole story growing up, you know, Dust Bowl, Texas. He said that, I think he was one of nine children, I want to say, and something like seven sisters. Mom was Native American. And he said, you know, we were so poor, our pancakes only had one side. The guy was great. And you know, he always, anytime he was talking, you know, he said, oh, I got another book. You know, I published, hell yeah, I do it again, but I'm working on another book. And then, you know, strategic silence. Oh, well, what's the title of the new book? Well, on second thought, you know, would be his response. So we were lucky. I spent New Year's Day at the Audie Murphy VA Hospital in San Antonio. We took the wife and all the kiddos down there. And, you know, we thought we were going to lose him before that. And he had a great day. You know, he was talking with us, my son and my oldest son and I. We went down in our Marine Corps P-41s, and I actually presented him with a new World War II Victory Medal that I had here, because I told him, I said, you know, Fred, you know, people like us don't care so much about the medals that they pin on you. That's for other people to care about it. You know, we don't, because our medal is coming home and raising a family and just breathing air. But other people seem to care. And I said, you know, I started thinking the night before I went to see him, we don't have a Korea War Victory Medal. We don't have a Vietnam Victory Medal. We don't have Operation Iraqi Freedom or Enduring Freedom Victory Medals. You know, he really is the last of the generation of fighting men, you know, that know what victory is. And that's pretty sad to think about, because the blood and the gore and the carnage and the bone and the pink mist in the air is the same in any war. But to know what victory's like and to see these guys slipping away. And of course, he was 98. He did it all. He said it all. You know, and it's just, what a treasure. So I'm asking, you know, all of our listeners to go on YouTube. I mean, he's done some great YouTube video interviews.